Welcome to NPR's Movie Podcast, your weekly serving of all things cinema from NPR News. This week, a couple of Oscar previews. First, a look at the marketing behind the twice-nominated film Frozen River. Then, an interview with the nominee for Best Actor from the film The Visitor. In non-Oscar news, Kenneth Turan has a review of the new 3D animated film Coraline. NPR's Bob Mondello starts us off with a review about a film for Star Wars geeks.
Geek alert, especially for Star Wars geeks. A movie called Fanboys opens tomorrow. It's about some devoted fans of the space saga that took place a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Bob Mondello says that Fanboys was made by fanboys for fanboys, but its appeal will likely be much broader.
It's a decade or so ago on a Halloween far, far away, and four high school grads costumed as Imperial Stormtroopers are hatching a plan. The release of George Lucas's fourth, or first, Star Wars movie, depending on how you're counting, is just months away, an event these guys regard as worthy of an epic quest.
Imagine it. We drive across the country in one night. We break in to the Skywalker Ranch and steal ourselves a prince!
Beer-fueled enthusiasm would normally fade by the next morning, but these are no ordinary Star Wars fans. One of them has issues with his father, another has a beat-up van outfitted like the Millennium Falcon, and they all know more about Ewoks and Tatooine than they do about, say, girls and planet Earth, something they establish when their Jedi worthiness is challenged at one point.
Episode 5 was directed by who?
Irvin Kershner.
You! In episode 6, when Leia shoots down two scout troopers, why doesn't she take one of the speeder bikes instead of walking?
If you pay attention closely, the speeder bikes were destroyed, okay? And then Luke refers to it later on in dialogue.
Impressive. I wasn't really worried about you, though. What was Luke Skywalker's call sign during the Rebel assault in episode 4?
Red 5.
You are all only as strong as your weakest link.
You'd think the weakest link in Fanboys would be that it's all in-jokes, but they're actually not so in that a casual fan won't get them. Director Kyle Newman and his screenwriters started with a Harold and Kumar-style road trip full of raunchy chatter, and then made the details equal opportunity nerdy, as when the Star Warriors encounter turbulence on the way to Skywalker Ranch from a whole other universe. A crucial file folder gets tossed to them by a familiar-looking figure in the shadows.
It's all there. Maps, passcodes, phony IDs to get you past the front gates. But that's not what's most important.
What's most important?
The shadowy figure, Starfleet Commander turned website huckster, steps out of the shadows.
We never met.
This is unreal. How did you score all this stuff?
Are you kidding? I'm William Shatner. I can score anything.
The Star Trek-Star Wars divide is heightened in a pair of battles with Seth Rogen, and there are cameos by pop culture figures Jay and Silent Bob, Princess Leia, and others. When a plot twist seems weird enough, you can generally assume it comes from a Lucas movie, and real fanboys will doubtless get things that flew right past me. As funny as Fanboys often is, it's not graceful, possibly because it had a troubled production history. The final film has a committee-made feel to it, but the committee was undeniably filled with geeks, fans, and maybe even a droid or two. And if the version of Fanboys they came up with is a little sloppy, well, think about it. Would you really want a Superbad meets Jabba the Hutt geek fest to be state-of-the-art? I'm Bob Mondello.
There is more on this week's new movies, including reviews of Push and Coraline, at npr.org.
The Motion Picture Academy rolls out the red carpet for the Oscars in just a couple of weeks, and a small-budget film called Frozen River could be this year's fairy tale success. It's up for two awards. The story it tells is anything but a fairy tale. It's about a mother who begins smuggling immigrants across the Canadian border in order to make the final payment on a new double-wide trailer. Nate DeMeo reports.
You can view Frozen River as a searing drama about what happens when people are pushed to their breaking points by unrelenting economic struggle.
That was an accident.
It's an accident. You shot him in the foot.
TJ. He spent the food money on scratch cards.
We've done it before.
Or you can view Frozen River another way.
I think the film is quite a Cinderella story.
A Cinderella story in which Michael Barker, the co-president of Sony Pictures Classics, is the fairy godmother. Every year around this time, there seems to be one small film that gets its big moment, the plucky upstart plucked from obscurity. The Frozen River version of the story started where a lot of them do.
At the Sundance Film Festival 1 year ago.
Where Barker goes every year. He says other executives go looking for the next Little Miss Sunshine, the next indie darling with mass market appeal. He's looking for something else.
The movie that is very high quality, but it's not a movie that's very obvious in how to sell or how to market it.
The magic here, the bibbidi-bobbidi-boo, if you must, that turns small, challenging movies like the bleak and often brutal Frozen River into Cinderella stories, is actually a methodical business plan that Barker and his team have honed award season after award season. It goes like this.
Our plan from the beginning was to open the film in August.
When fatigued moviegoers are seeking refuge from summer blockbusters.
We try to capture as many of the good reviews we can.
And the reviews for Frozen River were glowing. And with the glowing reviews, they could line up more screens. And when the company buys a tiny movie with non-stars and a first-time director, they get people willing to sit down for endless interviews promoting it. And all that good press put them on schedule to take their best shot at an Oscar nomination. A perfectly timed Oscar screener.
For the longest time, we're the only film that the Academy members had in their hand to watch.
Each fall, movie companies fishing for Oscar votes send members free DVDs. The first ones usually start showing up around Halloween. Frozen River went out at the beginning of September, before it could be buried under a pile of Benjamin Button and Dark Knight screeners. The plan worked.
For Best Original Screenplay, the nominees are Courtney Hunt for Frozen River.
Now, Sony Pictures Classics is reaping the benefits. It had scheduled the DVD release for right around now to take advantage of a potential nomination. And now orders are up. And when it's time to make deals with TV and cable, Academy Award nominee Frozen River will be much more attractive than plain old Frozen River.
Our goal is for the film to have the longest life possible, and Frozen River is probably a textbook example. And we keep going. We see what happens at the next stage.
Your classic Cinderella story. Your classic multinational media conglomerate orchestrated and executed Cinderella story.
Michael, he had a plan and an instinct on this.
That's Courtney Hunt, Frozen River's first-time director and now nominated screenwriter. An overnight sensation after 10 years fighting to get this movie made.
Well, I thought once I got into Sundance and sold the movie that I was a big shot. But it turns out not as big of a shot as I thought it was.
She says at each mile marker of the promotional plan, she's found that the movie business opens up to her just a little bit more. A win at Sundance gets you some exciting meetings. A good theatrical run gets better ones. And now, with an Academy Award nomination, she's a bigger shot still. The kind who can pick and choose her next project. Meanwhile, the folks at Sony Pictures Classic just got back from this year's Sundance, with a new set of movies about to get the Cinderella treatment. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMayo.
The Oscar category for Best Actor this year is loaded with terrific nominations. Sean Penn, Mickey Rourke, Frank Langella, Brad Pitt, and Richard Jenkins. Jenkins has been nominated for his performance in The Visitor. He plays Walter Vail, a quiet economics professor who discovers two people living in his rarely used New York apartment.
Sorry.
You stay away from me! You leave me alone!
No. It's okay.
My boyfriend is coming.
I'm not going to hurt you.
Who are you? What are you doing here?
This is my apartment.
This is not only Richard Jenkins' first Oscar nomination, it's his first lead role in a film. For some 30 years, Jenkins has played supporting and character roles in film and television. You may remember him as the dead father in the HBO series 6 Feet Under. Richard Jenkins is in our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you again.
So how does it feel?
How does it feel? It feels weird. It's fun. It's been a lot of fun, actually.
When you were a kid, did you practice Oscar nomination acceptance speeches in front of a mirror?
I mean, I was a bit of a narcissist, but I don't think I went that far.
No. Have you written a speech yet?
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, no.
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 No. Tell us how you got the role of Walter Vail.
Well, Tom McCarthy, the writer-director, and I were acquaintances, and we ran into each other in the lobby of a hotel in L.A. We were both doing movies. So he said, you want to go get something to eat? And I said, yeah. So we went out for dinner and talked for a couple of hours. And 2 years later, he called me up and said, I wrote this part for you.
What did you think when you saw the script?
I hadn't read anything that good, and I couldn't remember how long.
Huh.
I just absolutely loved it.
What do you think is the key to the character Walter Vail?
Well, I think he's really complicated, and I don't think Tom shied away from that. I don't think he tried to make him like a perfect person. There's a lot of self-loathing. He picks on a young student for no real reason, you know, just to make himself feel better, I think. And so he's a complicated guy, and I just love the way he was written.
He's complicated, but your acting is very subtle. I mean, the complication is almost his inner life. I mean, this is not a part that has a lot of histrionics.
No, it isn't. Movies do this so well that as an actor you have to trust that it will do this. And that is, when you go into a room with a lot of people, Walter Vail's not the guy you would notice. But the camera says, I think we're going to follow this guy for a while. And you just live your life. It's kind of like reality TV on film.
Isn't that what Tom McCarthy said, that he didn't want a big star for this role? I mean, not that you're not a star. You are.
And he got it.
No. Come on.
No, he did. He said he wanted an everyman. Actually, we were standing on the streets of New York. He said, I also wanted somebody who could walk down the street while the camera's on, and people wouldn't stop and say, oh, my God, who's Zick? Hey, look at that guy. Look. And as soon as he said that, some guy walked by me and went, I know you. I said, uh-oh, recasting.
The plot is really interesting. Walter, who is very disaffected, he's very unhappy in his job. He goes to his apartment and he finds Tariq, an illegal immigrant from Syria, and Zanuba, an illegal immigrant from Senegal. And part of the plot is Tariq is arrested for allegedly trying to get on the New York subway without paying. He's sent to a detention center, and this is all happening in the shadow of 9/11. And Walter seems to get energized by trying to help Tariq.
I think Walter thinks that now I'm here, I have a college degree, you know, I'm an economics professor, we'll take care of this. Now you got me involved. And he can do nothing.
I'm here for bed 38, Tariq Khalil.
Visiting hours start at 5 p.m.
What? I'm sorry, excuse me?
Visiting hours are 5 p.m.
I understand, but this is extremely urgent. Could you please check for me? Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Watching your character, I mean, it's a Hollywood term, the arc of your character, you know, go from, and there's not much change in, like, your facial expressions.
Well, you know, the temptation is to explain who you are as opposed to just be who you are. And I'm a slow learner, and I don't know if 10 years ago I would have trusted myself enough just to let this guy, just to let this life unfold.
And a lot of it we see, it's not the words that you speak, it's how you
Absolutely.
Behave.
Yeah, and that's Tom. I mean, Tom McCarthy is the most patient filmmaker. And when I saw this in a rough cut, I said, you really let the camera stay there. It lingers. So you see what these people, you can just watch them.
A lot of people know you, as I mentioned in the introduction, a lot of people know you from 6 Feet Under, and they saw you in Burn after reading. And Flirting with Disaster, There's Something About Mary. I mean, people are now going to go watch these movies again to see you. Are there roles that you think really allowed you to grow as an actor?
In some way, you learn from everything you do. Sometimes it's not a positive learning experience. My father always said, you can take away something positive from every experience. And of all the things he said to me, that has proven to be true.
Did he, your family, approve of your desire to be an actor?
You know, it's funny. Since the nomination, my hometown newspaper did a story.
That's DeKalb, Illinois?
DeKalb, Illinois, yes. And I didn't do any theater in high school, but I did a play in junior high school. And the teacher is still in DeKalb. And they interviewed her, and she said that after I did this play, my father called her and said he was worried because I was talking about wanting to be an actor. She said, I told him, let him do it, don't. And he never did. He never said, don't do this. I don't support you. I don't think it's a good idea. They were behind me 100%. But I had no idea that he had had this conversation with her.
Interesting. What are you going to wear to the Oscar ceremony?
Well, you know, I've just been trying on tuxedos, and the new style is everything is short. The jacket's short, and the pants are kind of low cut. And as my mother would say, all the kids are wearing them. It looks great on young people. When I put it on, I look like Jethro from the Beverly Hillbillies, you know. I need a rope belt. I found a tuxedo that looks great with white socks.
Richard Jenkins, Oscar nominee for Best Actor for his role as Walter Vail in the film The Visitor. He joined us from our New York Bureau. Best of luck to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here's an entertainment model just making a comeback. We had 3D commercials during the Super Bowl, a 3D show on NBC Monday, and new in theaters today, the movie Coraline in stop-motion 3D. Critic Kenneth Turan says it's worth putting on those funny glasses to see this movie.
The third dimension comes of age with Coraline. It's the first contemporary film where the 3D experience feels intrinsic to the story instead of like a godforsaken gimmick. Coraline is a remarkable feat of imagination, a magical tale with a genuinely sinister edge. The film tells the story of an 11-year-old girl's adventures in an alternate universe where her parents are not her parents.
My mother doesn't have buttons. Do you like them? I'm your other mother, silly.
Everything in this other world is livelier and more exotic.
They're cocoa beetles from Zanzibar.
But the other mother slowly begins pressuring Coraline to stay forever, and the experience becomes the kind of nightmare you can't wake up from no matter how hard you try.
I want to be with my real mom and dad. I want you to let me go.
Despite its PG rating, this film is not for the smallest among us. Coraline is written and directed by Henry Selick, responsible for The Nightmare Before Christmas. Selick is the preeminent practitioner of a painstaking, labor-intensive process called stop-motion animation. Stop-motion involves the frame-by-frame manipulation of tiny, three-dimensional models. So a table in this movie is a real table. A chair is a real chair. While stop motion creates a fantastical, imaginary world, the third dimension makes it so unblinkingly real, we feel we could walk around in it if we had to. Watching the story unfold in 3D makes a theatrical experience feel special in a way it hasn't in years.
You can hear these stories and more on our website, npr.org/movies.